It's Lucky's really long list of movies. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Lucky's really long list of movies, where I, your host, Lucky Damn Day, I dive deep into my really long list of movies that I have never seen before. And I break down this big old list of mine into categories. And each month we get a new category with four new movies to unpack.
Yeah, incredible!
We have a good time. Well, darlings, we just finished up the insane category of wild animals. And if you did not catch last month, I highly suggest going back and taking a listen because it was the most intense category so far. But whatever, we made it out alive. So now, we get to move on to this month, the month of December. The weather gets colder, hopefully, and we start to string up and ignite ceremonial lights. Families get together, or maybe families avoid each other, giving presents, and the pressure of getting the presents to give the presents. This month is supercharged with weird, whimsical, and ceremoniously stressful energy. And if you work in retail, Godspeed. No matter what you celebrate this holiday season, I hope it's super warm with a lot of cute moments and food or absolute solitude. Whatever you want, baby. I hope it's everything you need. So, what is this month's theme? Well, it's Christmas. It's Christmas, specifically Christmas movies, and I celebrate Christmas. Of course, I was raised Christian, so I have done the Christian Christmas. But these days, I really dig into the glittery, like super glittery, colorful, almost overwhelmingly colorful, cheesy, like super decorated, gaudy, flashy Christmas. So it's like a very dopamine Christmas. That's the kind of Christmas I like, the campy Christmas. I'm not really into like the giving gifts part, but I do love the matching PJs, cookies, themed music, themed decor, and all the food. And let's be honest, okay, can I be honest with you guys? Christmas and New Year's Eve, they are within a week of each other, right? And then New Year's is also just like at the end of this entire month. So New Year's is like the end marker, to my knowledge. There's a lot of holidays going on throughout the entire winter season. December, I just know that there's like a lot going on in December for a lot of people. And then New Year's hits and we all go crazy. So Christmas and New Year's, right? They're like within a week of each other. And both of these holidays, they encourage indulgence. So this entire week, this entire month of December and Christmas and New Year's and all this shit is actually just a big ol' excuse for us to dive deep into our vices. Maybe go a little overboard, especially at the office party. That is what the office parties are for. If you're drunk at an office party, don't get embarrassed. You did your job once again. So during this winter wonder whirlwind we will experience this month, I pulled three Christmas movies and one New Year's movie. I have never seen any of these movies before, but I am very, very interested in what the hell is going on in each and every single one of them. Christmas movies are mayhem. They are crazy. You know, these Christmas movies might give the wild animal movies a run for their money. So this month, it's going to be four movies, three Christmas movies, and one New Year's Eve movie. And I'm just really trying to figure out what the hell is going on in these movies. And then that New Year's Eve movie is supposedly like really good and really star-studded and not really like spoken about. So what movie is kicking off this month full of Christmas chaos? Well, it's Die Hard. Of course, the 1988 action movie that put Bruce Willis on the map and changed the action movie industry forever. And I originally thought that this episode would be spent on arguing how this movie is a Christmas movie, but there's a lot of Christmas in this movie, you know? Like, there's just a lot of Christmas in this movie. Does this movie put me in a Christmas mood? A little bit. And if you watch Die Hard every year around Christmas time, it'll absolutely put you in the mood. And this movie, it fades out to a Christmas song. So yeah, it's a Christmas movie and we are moving on. I'm more fascinated by the main character and everything he represented, John McClane. John had one-liners, he was the underdog, and he was like also like a cartoonish cop from New York. And this movie really, really showcased 1980s corporate culture and fashion. We even had a woman with shoulder pads and a strong perm and professionally powdered eyelids. She also had a nameplate and a desk and an office. There was an office party, and there was like that one guy who's like always on coke. There was a pregnant lady that wanted to drink. Marital issues. And no office party is complete, you know, without German robbers with machine guns. Merry Christmas, motherfuckers! All right, let's go ahead and dig into Die Hard from 1988. So excited! Okay, so last week, I think I started with my first take before the recap, and it felt wrong. It felt weird. I don't know. So this week, we are going to be starting things off with recapping the entire movie of Die Hard in less than 1 minute. Okay? Do you think I can do it? I think I can do it. Actually, no, I don't. This is actually kind of a hefty little plot that I wrote. Okay, let me actually hold on. What am I? Okay, sorry. Am I ruining the magic for you? Is this too much behind the scenes with me right now? Oh my God, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to get this lined up so I can read it. I need a new mouse. Anyway. We're going to be starting the timer. We're going to be starting it right now. James McClane was married to Holly Gennaro McClane, and they have two little girls. But James McClane lives in New York City, and Holly lives in L.A. And yes, the girls live with Holly. James is a New York City cop, and Holly is a strong, independent 80s corporate businesswoman. As an attempt to save their marriage, Holly invites James out to L.A. for her work party. Her holiday work party. John says yes and flies with his gun and a big teddy bear out to L.A., and then he lands and he goes straight to Holly's corporate office for this party that only plays American-themed music. Then these guys from Germany came into the building and during this Christmas party, and then they like stick up the place, and then they're trying to like break into this vault. But little did the bad guys know that a barefoot detective Joe Schmo from New York City is galloping around in the walls. John McClane. So John is running around beating up the bad guys and blowing shit up, and then the bad guys kill people, and then the cops show up, and then some of the cops blow up, and then some of the bad guys blow up, and then the main bad guy, there's like a main bad guy fight, and John McClane, he falls out the window, and John McClane, he doesn't fall out the window, but he's good. He won his life and the love of his life back, and the bad guy jumps out the window. See, it's hard. It's hard. Once I start to get cocky, it gets difficult. I almost made a dick joke, didn't I? Once it gets cocky, it gets hard. Die Hard! What, do you think we were going to get through an episode without at least one dick joke? This is Die Hard, baby. Okay, well, did you get all that? I sure as hell hope so. Yippee-ki-yay! We're gonna mosey on over to my first take. This is where we all jump on the back of a horse. Yeah, we'll all fit. And we'll jump off the roof of a 40-story building and we'll time travel into the past. We do this every episode. Well, this is the part of the podcast where we time travel back into the past to hear what I had to say about watching Die Hard for the very first time. Basically, I just made a recording after I watched the movie for the first time. Like I record when the credits roll. Okay, I'm going to try my best and make it sound like we're riding a horse off the edge of a cliff. No, off the roof of a building as a form of time travel. Challenge accepted. Let's go. Giddy on up, partner. It's the horse's name. The horse's name is Partner. Okay. Hi, it's me, Past Lucky, and I just watched Die Hard for the first time. Die Hard. I still don't know why it's called that. It was incredibly long. My camera ran out of memory, and it felt insanely long. I think it was the longest Christmas movie I've ever seen. And if I had to choose an argument, I would choose the argument of, yeah, Die Hard is a Christmas movie. Because it was a lot of Christmas in there. And it happened on Christmas Eve, and then the credits rolled to a classic Christmas song. And all the people lived that you wanted to live. And the bad guy died. Dramatically. Merry Christmas. This one's gonna be short. This one's gonna be a short first take. That was just very long. Bruce Willis's character was so cheesy and funny to me. Instant classic. I can see why. Fuck that media guy. Fuck the media. Fuck you, media. Damn, it was just very long. And then I saw this was like the first of many, and I was like, damn, damn. And I knew that shit was over money. And even the main characters were like, all of this is just because of money? And I'm also the same way. I'm like, all of this is just for some fucking money? $600 million? That's like clown money. Like, what are you gonna do? Why that much? What are you gonna do? What are you buying? Okay, you have $600 million. Now what? You have to be like on the run. How are you gonna spend it? On illegal shit? Stressful. I don't know. He was probably gonna spend it on evil movie villain shit. And he probably had to split it up with all the guys. You know, Jesus Christ. Anyway, I can't wait to dig into this a little bit more. I can't wait to really look into this from like a Christmas lens. Can't wait for that. Yeah, ho ho ho, bitches. What did he say? Yeehaw, motherfucker. What was it? Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. All right, that's enough. Okay, that was my first take. Okay. Fine, maybe I was being a little bit of a brat by being like, wah, this movie is so long. Wah, it is so long. But that's because, you know, like I said on my first episode, I need to watch stuff more than once. And I think that's okay. So when I watched Die Hard the second time, it really started to sink in. And I was like, oh my God, I like totally took so much of this movie for granted. Like all of the explosions, like the 80s atmosphere, the perms, the makeup, the clothing. The guy is barefoot the entire time. There was a lot to gobble up with this movie. And apparently, if you set a plate full of food in front of me, I might look at it and still go, I'm hungry because I'm a little brat. But it's okay. It's okay. I get it now. I like Die Hard, and I liked Die Hard when I watched it the first time. Okay? Okay. So here we go. We're diving into Die Hard now, everybody. So I need to be really honest about this movie. The behind the scenes, production, the script writing, the legacy, who's in it. There is so much about Die Hard. Like it is in the National Library of Congress for having a huge impact on culture. It's huge. It's very, very big. And I had no idea that this movie basically restructured the entire action genre. I didn't know people hated Bruce Willis. And there's so much. And I might not talk about all of it in this episode, but I'm definitely going to talk about the parts of this giant movie that caught my attention for sure. Okay, so before we get started, go ahead and join me in taking off your socks and shoes. And we're going to plant our feet flat on the ground. And we're going to make toe fists in the carpet. Because I'm nervous. I'm nervous about tackling Die Hard all on my own. I'm nervous about tackling Die Hard on my own. It's a really big movie. Okay, toe fists. It does work. I feel much calmer now. Much more grounded. So let's start with where it all began. Babies. The script. Well, Die Hard. Die Hard was actually adapted from a novel from 1979 called Nothing Lasts Forever by Roderick Thorpe. Okay. Nothing Lasts Forever is actually part of a book series or something. It's a book that follows another book. So Nothing Lasts Forever is the second book. And Fox adapted the first book of this series and made it into a movie. And then that movie did so well that they immediately purchased the rights to the second book, which is titled Nothing Lasts Forever. Okay? So what was the first book? The first book of this series? The Detective! Frank Sinatra, here you are again! Seriously, what? Again, Frank? We see you again? insane. It's like he's famous and in Hollywood or something. It's crazy. Anyway, I don't take back anything I said about the detective being a flop or unpopular or whatever. Yeah, so what? I maybe said that shit because I was standing up for Mia Farrow because Frank Sinatra did some weird shit. Yeah, what? So what? He can do whatever he wants and so can I. It's just nuts to me to think that Die Hard is kind of the sequel to The Detective. Bonkers. Hello. If you're new here, I just want to like get you caught up with like this is like the third episode where Frank Sinatra was mentioned. His last two mentions were weird. You know, I mentioned a little bit about what he did to Mia Farrow. And then he also like threatened the mafia. This is one of his more tamer mentions. This one is whatever because, you know, he's just an actor in this one. But, you know, The Detective itself, that movie brought a lot of drama to Mia Farrow's life. Like, because Frank Sinatra divorced her because she couldn't be in the movie because she was too busy starring in Rosemary's Baby. Anyway, back to Die Hard. In 1987, 20th Century Fox hired screenwriter Jeb Stuart to adapt the novel into a script. Now, here's the thing. Stuart was in a tough spot financially. His previous script had been scrapped, and he was barely scraping by. So Stuart's scraping and scrapping and scribbling, trying to save his life, you know? So when he was asked to work on Nothing Lasts Forever, he took it as a lifeline. What's interesting is that the studio actually gave him quite a bit of freedom, with the only stipulation being that the story had to stay in Los Angeles during Christmas time. Honestly, good call. That is so cool. This movie is corporate 80s, 80s LA at Christmas time, and it is a big ass action movie with big ass explosions. Die Hard is a vibe. I will say that. Die Hard is a vibe. Speaking of vibes, Jeb Stuart, the guy who is adapting this book into Die Hard, like I said earlier, he was going through some financial struggles, but he was also going through personal struggles as well. And these emotions that came up during this time, they just bled into the script. For example, the character of John McClane. John McClane! Who would go on to become one of the most iconic action heroes of all time, no big deal, whatever. Well, John McClane was partly shaped by Stuart's own experiences with his current relationship issues with his wife. And also, just like John McClane, Jeb Stuart, he was trying to reconcile with his own wife, right? In fact, the entire film's emotional core revolves around McClane's attempt to win back his wife, Holly, while also fighting a bunch of terrorists and robbers. Merry Christmas. So Jeb Stuart, let's just talk about his, like, personal life really quick. Let's talk about the strife that he was fighting through. So Jeb Stuart, he was working 18-hour days at Walt Disney Studios. And I heard his time at Walt Disney was not the coolest. So Jeb and his wife, one night, they get into an argument. And it was one of those big arguments that really suck. Like, it hurts, and you're angry, and you're sad. It's kind of like when it's raining and it's windy at the same time. So there's like no umbrella or jacket that can like shield you from the misery because you're just getting it from like all angles. So Jeb, he gets into this argument with his wife and he goes to blow off some steam on a drive, right? Cool. Good choice. Like if the fight's getting too intense, remove yourself, right? So this happened around like 1897. Right. So again, the moody 80s and Jeb is just driving down the highway or something. I'm imagining him in a hot red convertible, but he was in dire straits. So it probably wasn't a hot red convertible. But anyway, so he's driving down the highway or something and he's behind a truck that is hauling a bunch of refrigerators. And then one of the refrigerator boxes falls off the fucking truck right in front of Jeb. Like, he tries to swerve out of the way. Like, he doesn't react fast enough, or it was impossible to react that fast. But he hits it, and boom. Like, his life has changed forever. But get this, baby. Get this, baby. The box was empty. The box was fucking empty. What are the goddamn mother? fucking chances. Can you fucking imagine? I have chills, Jeb. I have chills all over my dumb little body. God, my heart would literally pop if that happened to me. I know it sounds really cartoonish. There's a giant truck full of refrigerators and one of the boxes just falls off the truck, but it's empty. But could you fucking imagine? And you're already pissed and sad and feeling all those emotions and then this just fucking happens? Ugh. So this wild near-death experience for Jeb Stewart makes Jeb go home to his wife and apologize. And they probably had mind-blowing makeup sex. Can you fucking imagine? And that is also the moment that he knew that he wanted the plot of the movie to revolve around the main character, John McClane, regretting getting into a fight with his wife right before all of these deadly situations unfold. And he's unable to get to her to tell her that he's sorry and that he apologizes. Like, Die Hard is about what if you never get to say goodbye? Oh, damn, Jeb! Right after a fight? Woo! Take it easy on me, baby! That's kind of heavy. So, before we know it, Jeb, he just like cranks out this script while he was shit out of luck. But then suddenly, while he's writing the script, he just starts to get like strokes of luck, baby. Gets incredibly lucky in more ways than one, if you know what I'm saying. We hope. We hope so, Jeb. We hope you got laid that night. All right, way to go, Jeb. So we got a script now. All right, the book has been adapted and Fox buys the script. And then screenwriter Steven E. D'Souza, he's hired to rework the script. So screenwriter Steve E. D'Souza revised Stewart's script due to his experience with blending action and comedy. When I watched it the second time, I was like, you know, there really is a really nice balance between action and comedy. And the little pops of comedy are what keep us so connected to like what's going on. Do I sound like an asshole yet? I feel like I'm just turning into an asshole just minute by minute. But it really does. Like if you have an action movie, you have like really good, well-placed one-liners, you get really good, well-timed reactions from the actors, you can have really good moments of like comedy. And those good moments of comedy in the action world can actually translate into like badass moments. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfuckers. Like that, that is not a serious line. That is a punchline and he delivers it so fucking well. Bruce Willis does, he is good with comedy. I will say that. Bruce Willis, he has really interesting, really nice comedic timing that I think is perfect for the action world. So Steven E. D'Souza, he approached the story as if the villain, Gruber, were actually the central character. D'Souza explained that without Gruber orchestrating the robbery, McClane would have simply gone to the party and then what? He makes up with his wife and they live happily ever after? Boring. So, you know, D'Souza, he believed that it is valuable to sometimes view the film from the villain's perspective as they drive the plot. True. And also, villains are just very interesting. So to help map out the building's layout, D'Souza, he used blueprints of Fox Plaza while he was writing. Which is cool because they do. They like slither in and out of the walls. They're like in open construction places. They're jumping from floor to floor. They're fucking around with the elevator. It's crazy. The script was continuously revised, both before and during filming. Additional subplots and character traits were introduced early on because Bruce Willis was still working on Moonlighting. The show, Moonlighting. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but that's what Bruce Willis was known from. He was known for Moonlighting. He would spend long, long hours on the show Moonlighting, and then he would shoot Die Hard at night. Seriously, Bruce Willis would go from being super charming and super flirty sitcom guy to being a barefoot maniac jumping off of buildings at night. And he did a lot of his own stunts. Can you imagine? The first gig of the day is this cinematic movie-length show where you have to carry the entire romantic energy of the show. Then you clock out of that gig, and then you go to your next gig. You go to a film set to do like a majority of your own stunts on a Christmas action movie. It's crazy, you know? Damn, dude. Like, I think $5 million was a fair price for your pay, sir. And we'll also talk more about that later, too. To accommodate this insane Bruce Willis schedule, director John McTiernan allowed Willis to take breaks and tasked D'Souza with writing new scenes, such as those with Holly's housekeeper, that confrontation between Holly and Gruber after Gruber took Takagi's life, and then also D'Souza wrote like the introductory scenes for Thornburg and more interactions between Powell and his fellow officers. So in the original draft by Stewart, Die Hard unfolded over 3 days, but McTiernan, the director, he chose to condense the action into a single night, inspired by A Midsummer Night's Dream. God, I am so tired of Midsummer Night's Dream. You know, I'm so fucking tired of it. But that's just me. That's just me. I have my own personal stipulations as to why I'm so fucking tired of hearing about Midsummer Night's Dream. Whatever. It's not about me. Moving on. So McTiernan also opted not to use terrorists as the antagonist, deeming them, quote, too mean. Like the terrorists, like it's just too much, right? So instead, he reimagined the villains as thieves motivated by money, making the story more suitable for summer entertainment without making the dynamics too political. You know what I mean? And I think that's kind of a good call because, yeah, this is very Hollywood. This is very shit that only happens in a Hollywood movie, I hope. McClane's character didn't fully take shape until halfway through production. McTiernan and Willis determined that McClane was a man who didn't like himself too much, but he was doing his best in a bad, bad, bad situation. And the famous catchphrase, yippee-ki-yay-yay, motherfucker, was inspired by cowboy lingo. The yippee-ki-yay-yay, motherfucker, is actually a callback to Roy Rogers. Anywho. Shit's just going down over here, okay? The walls are caving in. My toe fists are no longer soothing me. Anyway, so yippee-ki-yay-yay, motherfucker, is a callback to yippee-ki-yay-yay, kids. And this cowboy lingo was used to emphasize McClane's all-American persona. Just another New York City cop using cowboy lingo in near-death situations. So now we got a script, baby. Now it's time to cast this thing. So here's where the story gets a little interesting. I mean, the whole story is interesting. It is to me anyway. But this is where I start to get a little taken aback by the public. 20th Century Fox was in full summer blockbuster mode, and they needed a big star to lead this film. And I really want to drill into your heads how 80s it was when Die Hard was born. It was 1987 and 1988. The 80s are in full bloom. I'm talking leg warmers, spiky short androgynous haircuts. You know, everyone is on coke. Got it? Are we there? 80s? Another part of this super thick 80s atmosphere was the action heroes that would often frequent the movie screens. And the common action heroes of this time were Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone. Really big, really buff, really impossible looking people. And it's a vibe. Like, finally, we get to see these muscles in action, right? Like, what the fuck can these big ass muscles do? That was the action movie scene back then. So back to 20th Century Fox needing to cast a big fat star for this big fat 1980s action blockbuster. Originally, the role of John McClane was offered to a slew of Hollywood's biggest names. We're talking, like I just said, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, of course, Clint Eastwood, Harrison Ford, even Burt Reynolds, but all of them passed. But then there's Bruce Willis. Oh yeah, baby. At the time, Willis was known for his role in the TV show Moonlighting. Remember I said something about Moonlighting earlier? Well, Moonlighting, it's a comedy drama, and Bruce Willis back then wasn't exactly the first person you'd think for a gritty action film. In fact, many people back then, they thought he was an odd choice. I know. So moonlighting. Have you heard of it? I have not heard of it before Die Hard, but I went on Hulu and it is on Hulu. Just like Die Hard, you can watch Moonlighting. Well, I gave it a watch this morning. I was watching it all morning. And I just have to say that this show, Moonlighting, it's not like a laugh track 80s sitcom. First of all, the pilot is like an hour and a half long. It was like its own little movie. And it was also very 80s. I'm talking pastel pink silk sleepwear, artsy pastel mansions, synth music, and barefoot crust punks. And Sybil Shepherd is in it. Pretty delicious, if you ask me. And Bruce Willis in Moonlight, he gives off this, like, Slippin' Jimmy vibes from Better Call Saul. He's a slick talker, very flirtatious, very charming, and he's a detective at this shitty detective agency. And Sybil Shepherd is this model who actually owns the detective agency. It's got something to do with her writing it off on her taxes. But the vibe of the show is dramatic, mysterious, funny, flirtatious, and it turns into a murder mystery, but it's still so super flirty. It is so flirty. Willis in this show is also pretty slim. His build is very slim. Like, he's in shape, you know, but he's not like buff. He's not built. And he's also not really a tough guy on this show either. I mean, in the first episode, Sybil Shepherd is like, you punch with your wrists. And she just keeps bringing up how he cannot fight. And it's kind of funny because, like, you do. You see him try to fight and it's kind of crazy and comical. And he's not really a tough guy on the show. He's more of like a dreamboat, private eye, rough around the edges, lover boy type. He wasn't exactly the first person people were thinking for a gritty action film like Die Hard. Again, people thought it was weird. But Fox had offered this movie to so many big time actors, and then all the actors started turning it down, and then the second round of picks started turning it down, and the third round of picks started turning it down, and the summertime movie season was just creeping closer and closer, and Fox had to make a choice, and they chose Bruce Willis. Fox was initially hesitant about hiring Bruce. They were worried about his ability to carry a film like this. But Willis had one thing in his favor. He was willing to take the risk. And get this, he was paid a hefty $5 million for the role, which is huge for a TV actor at that time. I think it's huge in general. But that $5 million, that almost made people hate Bruce Willis even more. Apparently, Bruce Willis was getting a reputation for being stuck up. And what earned him this reputation? He didn't really want to talk about his personal life. He would rather talk about his acting in interviews rather than who he's in a relationship with. Oh, the asshole. What a dick. Oh yeah, speaking of the 80s, he married Demi Moore in Vegas after dating for only 4 months. And it's none of our business, okay? It's none of our business. Willis's casting was a huge gamble, but the gamble paid off. His portrayal of John McClane, just a regular guy, a cop from the big city, you know, trying to save his wife and survive, that struck a chord with audiences. McClane was not the typical invincible action hero, and that vulnerability made him relatable. In a genre full of muscle-bound supermen, McClane was different, and that was part of Die Hard's charm. Bruce Willis is very charming. I wonder if he's a Libra. Is he a Libra? Is he a Libra? 1 second. I'm going to look this up for myself. Bruce Willis astrology. Okay, that gave me a complicated answer. Star sign. Pisces! Oh my god, Bruce Willis is a Pisces. Okay, what's his big three? Oh, wow, I am nowhere near. He's a moon. He's a Pisces with an Aquarius moon. Me too. And he's a Virgo rising. Huh. Wow, I didn't get any of that right. Oops. Okay. Let's move on to filming. Okay. So let's talk about filming. And I also never gave Mick Tiernan. It's hard for me to say his name. It's hard for me to say everyone's name. And I'm super sorry. So Mick Tiernan, I never gave him an introduction. Well, you know, I was just getting like so swept up in the dramatics of making Die Hard that I skimmed over the director, Mick Tiernan. So the director, when I was looking him up, I was like, please be chill, please be chill, please be chill, please be chill. Because damn, dude, people love this movie and it really did do some cool stuff for the industry. And it's like this 80s corporate glam, like, please be chill so we can enjoy this movie. Well, I looked him up and I was like, oh, he truly is a big shot. Okay. So Mick Tiernan, he is best known for his action films, including Predator, Die Hard, The Hunt for Red October. So yeah, he's a big shot. Then, you know, I'm scrolling around in my research and then wouldn't you know it, this rich, white, successful, popular man in Hollywood has served time in prison. Shocker! Yeah, apparently Mick Tiernan likes to hire private investigators to illegally record conversations that his rivals, co-workers, and his wife are having. And then he fell into hard straits because he was sued by everyone that he was like secretly recording. And then he went through a hefty $5 million, $5 million divorce. And all this happened way after Die Hard, like between 2006 and 2013. Yeah, this rock bottom went on for a very long time. And he did serve time in prison, but the prison that he was in was literally just like a dormitory, like an old college dormitory that was converted into a prison. And this prison only held white collar criminals. And it is... And the prison was like called like one of the cushiest prisons in America or so. I don't know. It was annoying to read. It was annoying to read that fact. I'm like, okay, so there's, all right, cool, cool. Rich people just get a break everywhere. Yeah, yikes. Uh-oh, he went to jail. What a bummer. Let's talk about filming. Filming began in November of 1987, and it wasn't exactly smooth sailing. So most of the movie was filmed on location at Fox Plaza. That is the name of the iconic building. The building that's on all the movie posters. The building that is seen in every shot. The building that can be shot in any which way because it's so big. So they filmed on location at Fox Plaza in Los Angeles. And while this building looked great on screen, it created some unique challenges. For example, the residents, yes, the residents, people were living in there. People were living in that building during filming. And the residents, they weren't exactly thrilled about the constant explosions and the chaos surrounding the building all the time. In fact, some of them refused to turn off their lights during the exterior shots. And I mean, can you blame them? Can you blame them? Film shoots are, I'm going to be real, film shoots, they are exciting to be around for like the first 5 minutes. But oh my God, they get in the way. And my morning commutes have been fucked up because of this. My work has been interrupted by film shoots. I have had clients come to me late because of film shoots. And like when I say late, I mean late, late, like 30 minutes. I'm not getting my lunch break anymore late. But you know. It's all annoying. It's cool and annoying. But you know, film sets in your living environment, they are just very incredibly disruptive. So let me just list a little of what the residents had to deal with. So that was a real SWAT vehicle driving up the steps to the entrance of the building. And remember, they blew it up. One of the railings to the stairs was knocked over and never replaced. And I know that missing railing is eating someone up. That missing railing is making someone's ass itch. I can tell. I can feel it from here. I can feel it from here. There's somebody that's been living there since that building was made, and that railing is now not accessible, and they need that railing, and I just know they're still complaining about it. Oh my God. And in the scene where McClane, he throws C4 down the elevator shaft to stop an assault, the effects team unwittingly blew out every window on the floor of that building. They blew out every fucking window. Like, could you imagine? You are minding your own business. You're also paying rent to live here. Fuck, you know, not turning off my lights or whatever for your exterior shot. I'm not paying rent anymore because Hollywood is paying rent, apparently. I'm not paying rent anymore because my living has been compromised crazily. We're blowing up SWAT vehicles outside. My windows are getting blown out. You know, like, could you imagine, like, you're minding your own business and there is like random Christmas decor everywhere in your building because they're shooting a Christmas movie. And then the next thing you know, there's like a massive explosion in your building and then your windows fucking blow out. Do you know how annoying that is? Do you know how crazy it is to need your window? I can't remember if I've been there, but it's also just like one of those things where I'm like, I don't want to be there. I don't want to be without a window. I have gone without a window screen, and that shit drives me crazy. Bugs get in the house. Everything gets in your house. The cold, the heat, your AC doesn't matter. Your heat doesn't matter. If you have animals, like, now you have to try to keep them away from this giant hole in the wall. It's annoying. I'm right there with them. I'm right there with you, Fox Plaza residents. I'm sorry you went through this. Anyway, it still goes on. Don't forget that there was helicopter scenes, there was loud gunshots, yelling and yelling and so much yelling, and then all of this like equipment everywhere. And you can really fuck up your ankle on those little camera cords, film crews. You really can. Just saying. Anyway, I could not believe people were living in that building. I thought the building was empty. I thought the building was empty, and that's how they got it, you know? And then also here living in New York, there's so many buildings like that here that are just like empty, like nothing is in there. Like, New York is full of so many skeleton buildings. It's crazy. Ghost buildings. I don't know. What are we calling them? Tragic. Oh, and speaking of films, guess who the cinematographer is? Guess who the fuck is cinematographing this action movie? It's Jan de Bont, baby. I'm saying baby a lot in this episode and I like it. Yeah, the guy, Jan de Bont, the guy who was scalped on the set of Roar. I'm telling you, last month was insane. And Jan de Bont had one of the biggest injuries from last month. And last month, there was a lot of injuries. And he had the biggest one. His scalp was like ripped off. It was crazy. But I'm glad he got better. And he did a great job with Die Hard. He was really artistic. And there was like a lot of meaning behind a lot of stuff. It's really cool to look into. He paid a lot of attention to like lighting and prop details in every scene. Like, each off-kilter camera angle sends us a message that like something is off and not quite right. It's cool. And Jan de Bont got really artsy with Die Hard. And a lot of the explosions were real, baby. A lot of those explosions were real. And then when I watched it a second time, knowing that a lot of the explosions were real and how they were filmed, it literally looks like it was pulled off of like security footage, or it was pulled off of like maybe like someone's phone. Like, that's how personal the footage looked. Like, it didn't look like it was in a movie. It looked real, like real news footage or something. That's what it looked like. But the cameras were very, very steady. So yeah, Jan, he is fearless. As for Bruce Willis, he too was brave. He wasn't afraid to perform some of his own stunts, even the dangerous ones. So his most iconic stunt is probably his leap from the top of the Nakatomi Plaza with the fire hose tied around his waist. This stunt was not only incredibly difficult, but also dangerous. And that was the first scene Bruce Willis shot for the movie. Oh yeah, welcome to the set, welcome to the show. Jump off this roof. Oh, don't worry. Tie a fire hose around your tum-tum. It'll feel great. Anyway, the explosion from the building almost pushed Bruce Willis off the airbag he was supposed to land on. And some of the crew members even thought he almost died. Yeah, whoa. There were stunt actors, but Bruce did a lot of his stunts himself. I don't know. I love a stunt actor. If I ever get a stunt actor, I'm going to make sure that they get work. I'm going to make sure that they have a job to do. I'm not going to be doing any of my own stunts. No, I sprained my ankle and I thought it was over. Like, I cannot handle injuries. Speaking of stunts, let's not forget about Alan Rickman. Severus Snape, y'all. Rickman. He did so good in this movie. I loved watching him. Rickman, who played the unforgettable villain Hans Gruber, had his own daring stunt. The infamous scene where Gruber falls from the building wasn't really all movie magic. Rickman was dropped between 20 and 70 feet. I know that's a big gap. Was it 20 feet? Was it 70 feet? It was it somewhere in between? We can't really solidify, but it's between 20 and 70 feet. And the catch? He had no idea the drop would happen. So that look of genuine surprise on his face is completely real. Yeah, under the director's guide, the stunt guys, they were like, we're going to drop you on the count of three. And then they ended up dropping him on the count of one. And it did make for a cool shot. And when I saw this for the first time, I was like, how did they do that? Like, Rickman looks so good. He's acting so good right now. And also, and he just like kept falling. And I don't know, I was expecting him to be, I was expecting him to be like on a green block. And he's lying on his back and he's like, you know, like acting like a turtle that's been flipped on its shell. Ooh, I just got really nauseous, really hot, really nauseous. Whoa. Ooh, boy. Woo. Sorry, I just had a little bit of like a nauseous spell that was kind of big. That was a big one. Like, I forgot what I was saying. I got really nauseous. I had to sneeze because when I get nauseous, I have to sneeze because my body is cruel to me. Oh, woo. What the fuck was I saying? Ooh, you gotta love PMDD and all hormonal imbalances. Feeling like I need to puke every 5 seconds? Fucking phenomenal. I love it. I love it so much. Please never stop. Please never cure this symptom of mine. I love it so much. God, what the fuck was I talking about? Oh my God. Alan Rickman being dropped from 20 to 70 feet. Yeah, he did good. He did very good. It was really cool. They tricked him. And that's how they got that shot. You know, it wasn't digital trickery. It was just trickery with a little bit of digital. So we got the script, the well-paid actors, the angry tenants due to the big-ass explosions and shit. And now the movie is shot, edited, and it is ready to hit theaters in the summer. So the movie has been released. It is out in theaters. And the Die Hard that we know and love today was not an instant success. When the film first released, the initial reactions were mixed. Some critics criticized the violence and even Willis's performance. But when the film hit theaters in July of 1988, something unexpected happened. Word of mouth started to spread like wildfire. The movie did something revolutionary for its time. It introduced a vulnerable hero, one who could be hurt, and it didn't shy away from showing the cost of his heroism. It wasn't just about action, it was about a man fighting for his family. By the end of its run, Die Hard had grossed $140 million, making it the highest-grossing action film of 1988, and Willis's career skyrocketed, and Alan Rickman's portrayal of Hans Gruber made him a Hollywood star. Fast forward to today, and Die Hard is regarded as one of the greatest action films of all time, after mentioned in the same breath as Terminator, Lethal Weapon, and Aliens, all movies I have not seen. It spawned 4 sequels, and its influence can be seen in countless films that followed. Now, let's not forget its place in the Christmas movie debate. It's often cited as one of the best Christmas films, even though its status as a holiday classic is still being fought over. And I'm just gonna... Okay, fine, I'll get into the argument. This is totally a Christmas movie. Is Santa being shoved down our throats every waking minute? No. Are people drinking more than hot cocoa in this movie? Yeah. Is there cocaine? That is snow. That is Christmas. Cocaine is a Christmas drug. And I'm just going to say there is enough room in the Christmas genre for this 40-story explosive Christmas tale. Because it isn't just themed Christmas. It doesn't just take place on Christmas Eve. It just doesn't intro and outro on Christmas music. But the main story is about a man trying to fight for love and his family. And that is so fucking Christmas. That is so fucking Christmas. So there you have it. From humble beginnings, a controversial lead, and some truly risky stunts, Die Hard has become a cultural phenomenon that continues to captivate audience to this very damn day. It's a story of how an underdog film turned into a timeless action classic. A timeless action Christmas classic. Yippee-ki-yay, mother... Is it ki-yay-yay or is it ki-yay? Yippee-ki-yay, motherfuckers. I've heard it both ways. Not from Die Hard, but I've heard of Yippee-ki-yay and Yippee-ki-yay-yay. Whatever. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfuckers! Let's wrap this bad boy up. Woo! And that was Die Hard. That was our introduction into the season. Sorry, one second. Wow, the wonders of water. I'm back to life. So, that was Die Hard. That was our introduction to the season. Are you feeling it? Are you feeling ready for the holidays? Whatever the hell that means to you. We're going to be going into the holiday season. You can spend it here with me on the podcast. Hey, we're going to be digging into some movies about holidays and Christmas time. It'll be fun. So come join me next week when we take on Dolly Parton's Unlikely Angel. I am ready. I'm ready for Dolly Parton. I'm ready for a Dolly Parton Christmas. I'm ready for Dolly Parton being an unlikely angel. I'm so excited. I'm so excited. Oh my gosh. I'm excited. This might be the most peaceful, undisturbing movie, I fucking hope, since I honestly cannot remember anything before the Animal Movie Month. Because it was just so insane. Well, I'm excited to watch a movie that isn't going to be so intense. But then again, it could be just as intense. I don't know. I'm literally going to go watch it now. And I'll see you next week. Love you. Bye. Drink water.